Good afternoon and welcome to our last town hall meeting. I hope you have been able to join us for our other forums on education, affordable, sustainable growth, jobs and a living wage, and statehood and honest government. But if you have not, you can go to our website, www.michaeldbrown2014.com, and access them there. I'm looking forward to today's open forum so we can hear what's on your mind and what is most important to you. I hope you will join us with all your questions for our candidate for DC City Council at Large, Michael D. Brown. I am your moderator, Kathleen Gomez, and I'm here to facilitate the conversation, propose questions to the candidate, and make sure these meetings provide the kind of information you need to make an informed choice in the upcoming November election for DC City Council at Large. These town hall meetings are designed to give you, the voter, the opportunity to call in and have your concerns addressed by the candidate, your questions answered, and your voice heard on the issues that are most important to you and to our city. Por favor, unanse a nosotros en la conversación llamando al 888-429-5471 or Skype at BBS Radio 2. Early voting starts tomorrow, if anyone can believe this, at 441 4th Street, and Election Day is only 2 weeks from Tuesday on November the 4th. So today's discussion will focus on anything that's on your mind. Please feel free to ask a question on whatever issue is most important to you. I will take as many questions as possible, and I reserve the right to limit the time to ask or answer any one question. Let me point out that any question that remains unanswered at the end of the meeting can be submitted to Mr. Brown's website, www.michaeldbrown2014.com. Now, let me introduce the candidate, Michael D. Brown, for an opening statement. Well, good afternoon and welcome, Mr. Brown. I look forward to an interesting and lively discussion on this cold, wintry fall day.
Well, thanks, Kathleen. Let me start before I make an opening statement. Let me start by saying that, you know, I'm really proud of what we've tried to do here in creating a vessel for people to not only hear what we have to say, but also to get input from them and hear what's important to the voters. And I'd like to thank all the people that have listened over the last several weeks, and especially those who have called in, because I think it's important. The reason that we did this to begin with was because we knew there was going to be 15 potential candidates in the race. And we knew that the forums that were being held would not give us much of an opportunity to explore the different issues. And that's really happened. You know, we went to a forum the other night and, we got this 2 minute opening statement to tell you who we are. And then we got a few, minutes to answer questions, and it's really not enough to let the voters know what's on our mind and to hear what's really on their mind. So I hope people will continue to go to our website at www.michaeldbrown2014.com and find out what we're about, and I hope you'll call in today. I want to make my opening statement today on community policing, safety, and civic engagement, because those are all important issues that we haven't gotten to talk about. We've had a limited amount of time, and we've tried to concentrate on areas that are very important to us, everything from statehood to good neighborhood schools to affordable housing. But community policing, safety, and keeping everyone in our community safe is certainly a priority. And so I'd like to make an opening statement about it, and I hope you'll call in with questions on this and anything else you care about. The primary responsibility of any government is public safety. Crime in the District of Columbia is on the rise. According to the police union, sexual assaults are up by 50%, homicides are up by 107%, and robbery with a gun is up by 18%. The Washington Post reports that we're on the verge of a manpower crisis brought on by a mass exodus of officers who were hired in 1989 during a push to substantially increase the force and are now reaching retirement age. The department hired nearly 1,500 officers that year alone, and now many are about to retire. In addition, many younger officers are leaving the force to work in other jurisdictions. Meanwhile, 911 emergency calls are steadily increasing by more than 20,000 calls in a single year. Add this to the population that has recently grown by 7% while the department has been reduced, and this adds up to a public safety crisis waiting to happen. Safety is of paramount importance to our community. Currently, we are revising our gun laws, and the court has just handed down an opinion that will make carry permits available in the District of Columbia, and we're working out the details now. We need to take aggressive steps now to ensure that our community is protected. First, the mandatory retirement age restrictions should be relaxed in order to keep officers that have been on administrative duties. We need to free those officers up and put them back on the street. $6 million to $8 million should be added to the budget of the police department to hire civilians to serve that function, freeing up more officers for patrol. Although interim steps are important, we also need to develop a long-range plan on issues like public safety and community policing. In addition, a new coordinated effort to reestablish neighborhood watch programs must be started. We need to continue to use more passive crime deterrent measures like security lighting and localized public awareness campaigns. We need to, in addition to that, increase our fire and EMS service. Since October, we have had 15 arrests of DC fire personnel. In addition, the terrible incident involving gross misconduct in the death of Cecil Mills indicates a department in need of major reform. The review process and trial board that excused the negligent behavior of several firefighters with a slap on the wrist in the Mills case must be reviewed by the council. Current hiring freeze needs to be lifted. We need 50 to 75 new personnel. We need at least 2 new medic units, and 40% of all our ladder trucks are in repair right now and need to be replaced. Most importantly, there needs to be a review of the 911 emergency system, which has become overburdened and outdated. DC firefighters have done an outstanding job over the years, but we cannot afford to let this important link to public safety fall into a state of disrepair. And that's my opening statement. We need to beef up the police department, which is dwindling, and we need to put more resources into cross training and personnel in fire and EMS.
Let me ask you something, because I spent 20 years living in New York, and it seems to me that DC is really kind of even far advanced in some of the things, the situations where there's lack of affordable housing stuff. But one of the things that was a problem in New York, and I see must be with DC, is that none of the firemen could live in New York. So the cost of living is so expensive here. I mean, it seems to be as much as almost New York. Isn't there something that can be done to help police and firemen? I mean, isn't it important to have them living in your city than in Maryland and Virginia?
Well, it really is important to have them living in the city for many reasons. One, because if you have police in the neighborhoods are safer. People in neighborhoods know each other. I grew up in North New Jersey. We had a cop that lived down the street from us. Everybody knew where he was and who he was. And we lived in a pretty safe neighborhood. But also one of the other reasons that we lived in a safe neighborhood is that people were engaged with one another. And that's an important thing when I talk about reinstituting neighborhood watch. We need to use our ANC and other organizations to bring people closer together. If you were in my neighborhood and my grandmother didn't know who you were, if she didn't walk up and ask you who you were, called Officer I live down the street and asked him to go out and find out who you are. We really need to be engaged in our communities to stop crime. But to have police and fire personnel live in the neighborhoods is really, really important, especially after 911, when you could have an emergency and you've got firefighters and EMS personnel that live as far away as West Virginia. You can't, if you need to call these people in an emergency, look what happened in the Navy Yard. The Navy Yard incident brought in just hundreds of police from all over the area. Secret Service, DC police, Armed Services police, and they were able to contain the situation and get this shooter. Unfortunately, several people died. But if you had any kind of terrorist attack, or anything that required us to have a massive input of fire and EMS personnel, I hate to think that we'd have to bring them from as far away as two states to get them into the district. So I think we should provide incentives for these people and give them breaks on mortgages and give them an additional allowance for living in the District of Columbia. We get their tax money back. It's a win-win. You know, if you live and work in the District of Columbia, we also collect your taxes and you spend your money here. So I think we should provide incentives for them to stay. Yeah, I think that's very important.
And I know you were talking recently about the fact that there was, a recent city budget cut where didn't they cut the amount of police officers to fund? Was it last year's budget or something like that?
No, the year before, actually, our chairman, Phil Mendelson, according to the local police union, eliminated 400 police jobs. And this, on top of what I said in my opening statement, to me about having so many police officers ready to retire, you know, being a cop's a very stressful job. And so you have 1,500 officers that are up for retirement. They were hired in 1989. And that's a lot of cops to lose in a force which has a target of 4,000. You know, we want to have 4,000 police officers. We don't, we're about 500 short of that number right now. But if you lose 1,000 of those folks, who have now got their 25 years in, you know, I started in their early 20s. So they're in their mid 40s. They could serve for another 15 years. But they may want to go on to other careers. I think we need to provide incentives to help them stay. And, there's been a proposal by a councilman, actually he's leaving the city, Tommy Wells, to put up $8 million for that purpose. I think that even though the council rejected it, that they should revisit it and budget $8 million to provide incentives for police officers to stay and to hire civilians so that they can do the desk jobs, be trained to do desk jobs and free up MPD personnel to go back out on the streets. We also need, I just can't stress, and I think Kathy Lanier has done a good job. She's the chief of police, done a good job in starting this, but we really need to push for community policing. People beat cops, cops on bicycles, cops that have a presence in the neighborhood, and we need to get the neighbors involved. You know, I lived on Capitol Hill. I was involved in two crimes, both which resulted in the arrest of the perpetrators. The landlord, the little maintenance lady, the woman that ran our apartment complex, I lived in a small apartment complex with about 30 units. When I moved out, she retired. She said she didn't want to be in the building anymore because she didn't feel safe because I was very proactive in getting the police involved. And the police actually said to me, this is great that you've gotten us In one case, it was a very, very serious crime where this guy was using 8 and 9 year olds to help break into apartments, and he was armed. And they said it was great that, I was involved. And I said, well, I was raised in North New Jersey, and we all did this. We all did this because we understood that the guy that robs your neighbor comes back next week to rob you. Getting the community involved is just essential.
Well, it is true. I mean, in New York, I do know that it made a big difference when they did make this community, the community police.
Yeah.
And seeing your policeman and being able to talk to him and him knowing who lives in the neighborhood does make a huge difference in so many ways. Yeah. So you're talking now about the police and the firemen. And what do you think of the fire chief? I know I've heard people who support her and people who, would like to see her replaced.
In the police chief.
The police chief. Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, I think she's done a great job. I think that she has a tough job. She's taken over from chiefs in the past, some of whom were good and some of them were not so good. And I think that crime has steadily decreased. Unfortunately, with the reduction in manpower, it's been on the increase lately. But I don't put that at the door of Kathy Lanier. I think she's done a great job. And whereas I'm not so sure that we should be promising, the mayor should be promising to keep the school chancellor, she certainly should be promising to keep Kathy Lanier. I think Lanier's done a good job. And I think what she needs is some more support. And, she's really struggling with some things right now, like our new carry law. In the District of Columbia. Yeah. I mean, it seems crazy to me that we find ourselves in this position.
It's interesting. We've got a question that's been Skyped in. And that question is, there's been a lot of talk about affordable housing. What can we really do about it? And this was sent in by Juanita.
Well, there has been a lot of talk about affordable housing. Need to do a few things. And one is we need to put more money into the Housing Preservation Trust Fund, which was started and it was funded by the recordation tax. But since the recordation tax has gone down over the years and the need for affordable housing has done up, we need to find a new funding source for it. And we need to put at least $50 million a year into this. That's what one mayoral candidate is calling for, $50 million a year. Another is calling for $100 million a year. But I think we need to put at least $50 million into affordable housing, because just between the years 2000 and 2010, we lost 34,000 lost 34,000 units of affordable housing. We're about to lose more units because we've got 45 multi-unit buildings that are about to reach market value because they're 15-year loans, which require them to provide affordable housing, are about to expire. And so we need to do several things to combat that. We need to offer to refinance for these people, anybody who wants it. The developer or the landlord may not want it. And we need to also offer subsidies to people in those buildings so that we cushion the blow from the increase in rent from regular to from the subsidized rent where it is now to market value. We need to fill in that gap, and that's going to take some money. I was against giving the $500 million back to the taxpayers. There's so much we need to do in the city that we could have used that money for, and 10% of it could have gone to affordable housing. Another thing we need to do is we need to change the inclusionary zoning laws, which allow people to skate through lots of loopholes in providing affordable housing. 26,000 units of housing have been brought onto the market in the last, 18 months, I think it is, 18 months to 2 years. And of that 26,000 units, there hasn't been one affordable housing unit, not one, because people get to skate through these loopholes that are in the law. So those laws need to be tightened. And another thing that we need to do is we need to spread affordable housing out through the city. It shouldn't just be concentrated in low income areas. We also have 400 units of vacant housing that need to be rehabbed. We need to take a new look at the community initiatives program, the new communities initiative. It was a great idea, but it's been underfunded and it was overambitious, and they've only opened one project under it. Berry Farms needs to be renovated and kept open in Ward 8. There's just a myriad of things we need to do, and we need somebody to focus on this. And I think that it's enough of a crisis in the District of Columbia that the new mayor should appoint somebody to be a deputy mayor in charge of housing and sustainability in the district.
Well, here's another interesting question by Danny Morales, and he says, why doesn't the council take a harder stand against the court's decision about the gun laws? I guess that, you know, their whole decision and that we couldn't maintain the laws that were passed within the D.C. City Council. So I guess his question is, why can't the D.C. City Council do something to say enough is enough?
Well, you know what? Their hands are tied. They've tried to do that. I wouldn't fault the city council for their attempts to try to deal with the gun laws. But the big problem in the District of Columbia is statehood. We don't have control over what goes on in this city. So our laws are constantly under attack by Congress. And even though gun laws or expansion of our gun laws has come through the courts, some of it has really been promoted by activity in Congress through the NRA and other groups are constantly attacking our gun laws. The court has decided that our gun laws, which stood for many, many years, were unconstitutional. Now they've decided that even though we've changed our gun laws, that the right to carry a gun in public should also not be infringed. That it's also a violation of the Second Amendment of the Constitution if we don't have a carry permit in the district, which allows people to carry and people from other states with gun permits to carry. So what the council has tried to do is they've tried to create a tough set of criteria where you need to show that you have a need for a gun before you can get a carry permit. And we'll see how that goes. I mean, I think the council, this is one area in which I don't really blame them for anything. I think they worked really hard to try to come up with a good, solid, workable gun law, along with Kathy Lanier, to keep us all safe. But it seems crazy to me that we can't make gun laws, you and I have talked about this in the past, Kathleen, that they need to fit the jurisdiction. You know, what might be appropriate gun law in Arizona and what might be appropriate gun law in the District of Columbia or in New York City are completely different things. And look at all the dignitaries we have here. We've also been subject to two terrorist attacks in our history here in the District of Columbia. You know, we just had a guy jump over the fence and make it all the way into the White House. It seems to me that we need to have different gun laws than they have everywhere else in the country. And if we were a state and we had statehood and we had equality and control over our own laws in the District of Columbia, we'd be in a better position not only to make our own laws, but then defend our own laws. And, you know, part of the problem with the federal courts, the three-panel court that made this decision, is the fact that in the district, we don't have voting senators. In most states, when there's appointment to the federal court, the senators get involved. But in the district, Senator Strauss and I, the best that we can do is, you know, offer our opinion on the subject. We have no vote. We have no power in the Senate. And so we get judges that are really considerably more conservative than this jurisdiction, which is pretty liberal, would have under other circumstances. So again, by not being a state, by not having control over our own destiny, we suffer from this.
Well, I just kind of find it intriguing. I mean, we've had so many attempts in the president's life, from John Hinckley, who almost did, you know, kill President Reagan at the time. And, you know, this past couple of, I think there were two guys, wasn't there? One got over with a knife and one was found in the White House. That it would seem crazy to allow people to come in, like from Arizona, where it's, you know, you can get a permit easily and then come to D.C. And how are they going to be able to tell who's on federal in D.C.? I mean, this is a crazy situation. But here's another question that is up here. Let me read it. And this is from Susan. And it says, in was reading the article in the Washington Post today about budget autonomy. What does this really mean?
Well, again, the court is now deciding on a challenge to the fact that we had a referendum. It's a little complicated. In the last election in 2012, we had a referendum on budget autonomy, that we would actually control our own budget here in the District of Columbia. But after the referendum was passed, we got an opinion from the Congressional Research Service that the referendum was illegal. It was a violation of our home rule. So the city council went to court and they said it wasn't a violation of the home rule charter, because the charter gives us the right to change our, you know, the way our city is set up, the way we do things in the city. We're allowed to amend the charter. But unfortunately, what we're talking about here is not amending the charter, or at least that's the opinion of the mayor and the attorney general. It's also my opinion. We're not amending the charter. We're amending the relationship between the district and Congress, since Congress has control over our budget. And the Second Amendment, I'm sorry, the Article 2 of the Constitution is very, very clear. It says exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever, meaning that Congress has control over the District of Columbia. So whereas we can amend our own, the way we function internally, we cannot amend the relationship that we have between Congress and the District of Columbia, except by, again, becoming a state. So once the court pretty much decided that it was a violation of the Home Rule Charter, the head of the city council, Phil Mendelson, decided that he was going to appeal the case. And so that's what they've done. They've appealed it. And in the Washington Post today, they said that the three-judge panel had many questions about the appeal. So it looks like it's not going to, you know, if I had to guess, I mean, this is premature probably, but if I had to guess, I would say it looks like it's not going to get anywhere, that we're going to lose the appeal. And we just waste a lot of time with this nonsense. We waste time with this. What we should be doing is going for all of our rights. We're not doing that. We're not pursuing it vigorously. You know, in the Senate, we just recently had a hearing on our statehood bill. The President of the United States says he's for statehood. The head of the United States Senate, Harry Reid, has endorsed statehood. We have leaders in the House that support it. People like Nancy Pelosi. Both the senators from Maryland are co-sponsors of our bill. One of the senators from Virginia is a co-sponsor of our bill. We have representatives from both states who are Maryland and Virginia who are co-sponsors of our bill. And we have 129 co-sponsors overall. So we're really making a move on the statehood front. Meanwhile, the people on the city council are screwing around with these little incremental changes, which are never going to happen anyway. They're never going to happen because we don't have control over our own destiny. And there's no way to make them happen until we make that happen. And they seem to get it. So they're talking about funding the congressional delegation with nickels and dimes when they should be standing behind us and pushing hard like the rest of the city is doing and people on Capitol Hill are doing for statehood. But I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think we're going to get this referendum passed. And you know what? This is going to affect the referendum we have on the ballot this time. We have a marijuana referendum on the ballot, and if it passes, it's subjected to the review of Congress, and then after Congress reviews it, who knows if it'll end up in the courts or not. We need to get control of our own destiny, or we're just going to be fighting this stuff forever. And you know, we've been fighting it for the last 213 years, so we all should remember that. We have a council candidate, a young man, who keeps on quoting Albert Einstein, he says, said that doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result is a definition of insanity. Well, that's what we do. We do things over and over again when it comes to bothering with the federal government or it comes to messing with Congress. We use the same approach every time we're beaten down, but we don't seem to be getting the message. It's time to stop this nonsense and move on and become equal citizens of the United States. We've paid our dues. It's time to make it happen.
Well, I guess this is the thing that, and we have another question that's been Skyped in, and maybe we'll come back to this because I think that people see statehood maybe as on a different level than the city council, and maybe it would be good if after this question or now that you could talk about how important it is to have someone who's in favor of statehood on the city council and what they can do to help the movement go further.
Well, Tab, you know, this is really why one of the main reasons that I'm running is to have somebody on the city council that represents the interests of the people of the District of Columbia to get statehood. We have, like you say, support in the Senate, support from the White House, support from the people, support from the Congress. The only people we don't have support from are the city council. Now, we have a $9.5 billion budget, which they have control of. So they have control of all the money and all the laws in the District of Columbia, except for the fact that ultimate control rests with Congress on both the money and the laws, but locally they have control of these things. And we need to get somebody on the council that can allocate some money, can use the bully pulpit that they have, can energize the people in the District of Columbia to stand up for their equal rights. And until we get that, it's never going to happen in my opinion. And the thing is that the council now is reluctant to do it because statehood doesn't do anything for the city council. Right. It doesn't give them any more power, any more money. The only thing that statehood does is it does for the people. Those are the only people that benefit from statehood are every citizen that lives in the District of Columbia. But the city councilman, whether you're a state senator or representative or whether you're a councilman, you have the same amount of control. In fact, they might have less control because we would have voting United States senators. We'd have voting representatives in the House. And I think they fear that. But, you know, we need to stand up and be equal. We're the only country in the world that does this. And until we get somebody on the city council that actually stands up for the rights of DC residents, it's never going to happen. And there are people running for this office that in passing use the word statehood, but I'm the only one that's running out of the 15 candidates, I'm the only one who's made it the center of what I do. For the past 8 years, I've been the advocate, one of the advocates for statehood in this city. And we've taken the argument from one vote for our member of Congress to statehood. That's what we talk about now. That's what we're pushing for now. And I was instrumental in helping make that happen. And I need to be on the council to make sure that we take the next step and that we actually accomplish this.
Well, that's what I think is a very, very true statement. That it seems to me, with all the talk and all the things that are going on with the courts, that really nobody can be sure of anything unless you're state. You can pass all the laws you want, but there's always somebody in Congress who can say, nah, I don't like that, and put a stop to what you've already decided you want to do and the laws you want to live by. But here's a question from Iris. And she asks, she says, Muriel Bowser said she will keep the chancellor. The school system still has huge divides in the education it offers D.C. children. What are your thoughts about keeping the chancellor and improving education in D.C.?
Well, that's a big question. Thanks, Iris. It's a good question. Excuse me. But that's a very big question. And first of all, I don't think that you commit to keeping the chancellor because the school system is failing so many children. And although I know she can't be simply replaced, she can't be simply removed. You have to find a replacement for her. I don't think you vow to keep her the way things are going. I think that you do that, if the school system, which is improving at a snail's pace, continues to improve, that you certainly consider that. But I don't think you give her carte blanche and say, yes, we're going to keep her to keep consistency, which is what, one of our leading mayors, candidate, the woman actually that I support, Muriel Bowser, has said. She said, we're going to keep her because we need consistency. Well, I don't know why we need consistency in a failing school system. Almost half of our children go to public charter schools these days. And the reason there are so many public charter schools in the District of Columbia is that the regular school system isn't working. So we need to do a few things. First of all, we need better tracking of students. We have 50% plus in some high schools dropping out. We need to find out why this is happening. We need to track children going from regular public schools to charter schools, find out why that's happening. We also need to look at both public and charter schools and see what's working. Excuse me, a third of all public charter schools that have ever opened in the District of Columbia are now closed. So charter schools are doing better in some regards, but they're not doing as well in other regards. We need to find out what's working and replicate it, and what's not working and get rid of it. Alice Rivlin, who's an icon in the District of Columbia, wrote a book called Systematic Thinking for Social Action, where she makes that argument that what you have to do with all social programs, including schools, is to track them very, very closely so that you can find out what are the best practices and replicate those and eliminate the practices that aren't good, the ones that aren't working. And that's what we're not doing. On top of that, we're changing too much. We talk about consistency in our public schools, but every year there's a dramatic change. I'll give you an example. Over the last several years, even though technology is just exploding for these kids, we've removed one third of all public school librarians from the public school system. One third of the school system doesn't have functioning library media specialists, qualified library media specialists. Now, last year, they've decided that this year we're going to try to have a library media specialist in each school. And that's great. That's the way it should be. But why did they get rid of them in the first place? And why don't they come up with a consistent plan that they follow year after year? It's one thing to tweak a plan. It's another thing to completely change it. They're putting millions of dollars into new initiatives this year that they got rid of last year. And it seems to me that we're using children in our public schools and our charter schools as guinea pigs. We need to also deal with the funding formula for private schools, for charter schools, as opposed to public schools. We have to deal with the new boundary plan, which needs to be tweaked, and seems to me to be premature. You know, should we be shuffling students all around the District of Columbia before we have good schools in every neighborhood? I don't think so. I think it needs to be put off. It needs to be tweaked. Obviously, it was worked on. The boundary plan was worked on by a group of committed parents and community leaders, and they've come up with a decent plan, I think. But there's a few problems with it that need to be straightened out. And in the meantime, we have to make a serious commitment to making better schools before we just go off willy-nilly and 2 years from now change to another plan. So if we want consistency, we need consistency in a plan, not just in a leader. So that's what I think about keeping the chancellor. I think that it's an iffy position.
We have Joanne on line one. Joanne, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Joanne. Do you have a question for Michael Rapp?
Yes, I do. I'd like to know what he plans on doing with the metro system. They've spent the surrounding states in the District of Columbia have spent millions of dollars to put in the new Silver Line, which is swell if you want to go shopping at a posh shopping center out in Virginia. But what has it done for the District of Columbia? There's no new cars for the new line. All that it's done is rerouted two other lines that were already there and has caused further congestion. What can be done about that?
Beyond riding a bike or taking a cab or hopping on a bus, I think a lot can be done about it. First of all, we need to get the federal government to step up to the plate on transportation. You know, so many federal workers ride on the metro, and the federal government doesn't pay its fair share. You're absolutely right about the Silver Line. The Silver Line is a great idea. It reaches out to the further suburbs, and eventually will go to Dulles Airport. But it's causing congestion because it's using the same tracks as other metro lines, the blue and orange line. So we need to invest more. Because the system's old. The system is, I was in high school when they were building it, so it's more than 40 years old. We've had the metro longer than we've had self-government in this city. And we need to, invest. I mean, which one of us hasn't been in a metro station where the escalators are broken? And it's always the up escalators. I'm not sure why the down escalators are seen the break, but it's always the up escalator, you know, which just adds insult to injury, doesn't it? As you're huffing and puffing, if you're an old guy like me, stopping every 12 steps to catch your breath, and you're watching all the people glide down the other side of the metro station. So we need to put some money into this, but we also need to develop alternative transportation, I think. That's one of the reasons that I'm behind the streetcar line. It's green technology, and it gives us a light rail system above ground, which is less expensive than a light rail system below ground. So it's a thing of the future. And I know that it hasn't worked out well so far. We put a lot of money into it, and the only place it goes right now is down H Street. But I think we need to extend it into Anacostia, and it is a thing of the future. So I think we need to keep on working on it. And we also need dedicated bus lines. You know, I grew up in New Jersey in a family we had 8 or 9 people. We had an extended family, aunts and uncles, my grandmother. And we lived in a house with one car, but we had a great bus system. You know, today you can go on your cell phone and you can find out when the next metro bus is coming. And it's a great idea. But in Newark, when I was a kid, you could walk to the, they came every 15 minutes and you could walk to the corner. They came like clockwork, you know, never 16 minutes, never 14 minutes. They came 15 minutes. You could count on it. And I mean, if you could run a bus system like that 50 years ago in a city that's in population, when I was a kid, Newark had at least twice the population of the District of Columbia. We had over 1 million people. I don't know why you can't run a bus system like that here. We need dedicated bus lines. We need some bus lanes in the inner city. It's tough. Everybody's calling for them. It's tough because the city was never really made, designed for, surface transportation. But I think that's what we need to do. We need to put more money into the metro system. We need to get the federal government to put more money into the metro system because it needs to be upgraded. And before we extend the Silver Line any further, we need to deal with some of the things like the bottlenecks that we have. We also have another problem that's looming that nobody talks about, and that's the Virginia Avenue Tunnel, the VAT, which is actually a commercial line. It's a tunnel that runs through Southeast Washington on Capitol Hill, and it's really for commercial trains. It's owned by CSX, but the fact that the trains back up there also affects commuter traffic on light rail and metro coming across the river and coming in from Virginia. So we also need to deal with the BAT, and we're doing that. That project will start soon, but that's going to take another 3 years. We also need a dedicated fund for metro repairs. In 2016, they're going to close for 14 weeks in a row, they're going to close parts of the Red Line to do maintenance. That's the schedule right now. That means for 3.5 months, they are going to close the Red Line and cause lots of problems because they don't have a dedicated fund and a good working plan to keep maintenance so that we can keep the system open. Chicago, we ought to send somebody to Chicago and New York to study their subway system because they do a much better job than we do.
London has one that's 140 years old and it still operates better than ours does.
Yeah, I mean, I was up there recently a few years ago and was amazed that it not only worked better than ours, it's significantly cheaper than ours. I think my son and I went to Yankee Stadium, which is up in the Bronx, I believe, and we went from Lower Manhattan, and I think we paid a buck and a half a piece each way. In the District of Columbia, it could cost you up to $8 a day to go and come on the metro system, and that's ridiculous. We need to, you know, I don't know why we spend all this money and we have a system that's not as good as the system in New York, for example, which you point out is 140 years old. And I don't know if you've read the Post recently, Joanne, but they're now saying that Washington, D.C. is a more expensive place to live than New York. So, you know, and one of the really escalating factors in the whole livability and the cost involved in the district is transportation. So we really need to, address this, and the metro system is one of the important things that needs to be addressed. So thanks for that question.
Just a follow-up, how about a commuter tax for our friends from Virginia and Maryland that come into the district all the time? Charge them $8 a day, and it can pay to fix up our public transportation or have them leave their cars at the border.
Well, you know, that's a great idea, except for one thing. Congress won't let us do it. And recently, when the tax, when we had our recommendations on tax from a blue ribbon panel that had been put together and worked on it for years, they suggested a $100 tax, basically a $100 fee for employers to pay for everybody that lived outside the city and worked inside the city. Now, if you lived in New Jersey and worked in Manhattan, you not only would have to pay part of your income taxes to the state of New York, but you also have to pay them over $100 in 2.5 weeks to travel through the Holland Tunnel every day, or the Lincoln Tunnel. So that's a commuter tax, but we don't get to do that. If we could charge for coming across the 14th Street Bridge and the Key Bridge and et cetera, or we had put the $100 tax in, or the $100 fee in for employers. I mean, when I ran a business in this city, I ran a small business, small consulting firm, and they charged me $100 tax every year to build a new stadium. And we can't charge for a new stadium for the people of Virginia, basically, because if you've ever been to a Nats game, there's more people from Virginia and Maryland than there are from the District of Columbia. But we can't somehow either put a commuter tax on or do this fee. And in fact, instead of putting the $100 fee on, which would have made sense, they decided to tax yoga. You know, they put in the yoga tax, the tax on health clubs and other service businesses.
Let me ask you a question. Is there any system that actually there's reported to the public where they audit the metro system? Because I have told you, coming back, I was floored by the cost of $8 to go from, I think it was Tinleytown, down to Galleria Plaza, and all the escalators were broken. I mean, that's very, very expensive for an inner city transportation system. And it seems like they would be able to support growing and maintenance based on the rates that they charge people.
Well, it's $8 round trip and in rush hour and approximately. And yes, of course they audit it. But, the Metro Board is made up of three jurisdictions. It's Washington, Maryland, and Virginia. And of course, whenever you get three distinct bodies together that all have their own priorities and all have their own agenda. It's never easy and it's never efficient. We have several members on the city council who have served on the Metro Board and they've done a terrible job. Michael Brown, who's now in jail, when he was on the Metro Board, I think that said he never showed up for a meeting, never one meeting. So, you know, we need to stop that. The people that represent the District of Columbia on the Metro Board need to be tough with Metro and make them more accountable. I think that's a good question. Yeah, there's plenty of audits, but, you know, they don't, that's really not the problem. The problem is the way we spend our money. Not how much spend. There's a lot of leakage, I believe, and we need to tighten it up. The director of Metro, a guy named Sarles, who has brought the Metro Board, has brought safety back to Metro, after a terrible tragedy that we had several years ago, is about to leave. We had a great director, a guy named Dan Tagliani, who has moved on to the Wilson building and then moved on to the federal government. It's hard to keep people in that position because it's such a tough thing to stand in between all three jurisdictions, but we need them all to step up to the plate. And we need to develop alternative transportation too. The metro system is not going to be the only thing that takes us into the new millennium. I think it's a good thing that we're doing dedicated bike lanes. I think we need direct route buses, some more bus transportation that are in dedicated routes and in their own lanes. Although that's tough during rush hour and other peak because the city really isn't, you know, made for a lot of car traffic, and we're getting more and more and more every year. So we need a solid transportation plan. And I'll tell you, there was an intermodal transportation plan done in the Florida Avenue section of the city, which addressed the specific needs of that neighborhood. And I think we need more studies like that, because I think from neighborhood to neighborhood, the demands are different.
Well, let me ask you, I think you would get a lot of points too. Is there any way you can sync the lights in the city? I mean, with that, isn't that something under the control of the city council?
Well, yeah, it should be. I mean, certainly they do it in other cities, and they change it from time to time, you know, depending on whether it's rush hour or what's going on. And certainly we're getting new technology that's going to allow you to do that with cars. In a few years, your car is going to be able to interact with every traffic signal. So we really need to do some of that, but it's expensive, and I don't know that we have the money budgeted right now to do it. That certainly would help. Yes.
It seems it would help. The traffic is definitely dismal in DC. I would even say it's more dismal than New York City, because they somehow sync their lights with traffic flows so much better than it does here. But that would be something that I think every person who drives in the city would love you if you would be able to help them on figuring out why that can't be a better way.
Well,
it's just
the investment in the technology to do it. That's all.
That's true.
And if we can invest, you know, and maybe we should have some dedicated income streams, like, you know, I believe in red light cameras because they save lives. And we've seen revenues go way down with speed cameras, which show that they're working too, because people are changing their behavior. But maybe that money should be dedicated to developing those infrastructure things that will allow us to better synchronize lights.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. That's something that nobody talks about, but everyone I've been in a car, that's the first thing out of their mouth is, why aren't these lights synced so it flows better? So I think you'd win a lot of votes. At least you'd win my vote if you did something like that.
Okay, well then, well, I will immediately do that tomorrow. I will go out and single-handedly change all the lights.
Well, look, it looks like we're running out of time. So I'm going to let Mr. Brown make some closing remarks. And remember, you get to vote for two. So consider carefully both of your choices. And most importantly, remember to vote this November 4th. You even have an extra week before that for early voting. And it is so important. Again, don't forget, you vote for two. Mr. Brown, your closing remarks?
Well, again, I want to thank everybody who's tuned into these town hall meetings. It was an experiment that I think's worked well in getting not only our message out, but getting input from the voters. And I hope that you will all go out on November 4th and vote, or take advantage of the early voting, which really takes place. It starts Monday at 4:41, but there's early voting centers all over the city. There's 9 of them. There's early voting in each ward of the city, and you can go to boee.dc.gov. That's the Board of Elections, and they will tell you where and when the voting, early voting is open. It starts on the 25th, and it runs the 25th. And the 27th through November 1st, it's opens at 8:30 in the morning and is until 7 o'clock. So get out there and vote, and understand that you have two votes. And I want you to make your second vote a vote for statehood, a vote for better government, a vote for Michael D. Brown. Because for the past 8 years, I have represented you in the area of equal rights. And that's something that we need to move on to the city council. We need to be equal before our city will ever become the city that it's supposed to be, the city that it can be. We talk about the achievement gap in schools, and it's terrible, but there's an achievement gap across the city. The top 80% of our citizens make $250,000 or more a year. The bottom 20% make less than $10,000. We're the most educated city in the world, more graduate degrees than any other city, but we have a third functional illiteracy in our city. 33% of our residents can't read the newspaper. Unemployment in Ward 8 is three times it is in Ward 3. So, you know, we've had many people campaign on the idea of bringing the city together and having one city, but it hasn't happened yet. And you need a strong advocate for your equal rights on the city council to make it happen. I'm that person. On November 4th, go out and vote for Mike D. Brown. I'm number one on the ballot, and I'm your best choice for a better D.C. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael Brown, and thanks for joining us. Please remember to vote and get your friends, family, and neighbors to do the same. As mentioned previously, this town hall meeting will be archived on our campaign website, and I encourage you to share it with others who are interested in the upcoming election. Remember that you can submit questions to the campaign website, and we will do our best to answer as many as possible. Again, that address is www.michaeldbrown2014.com. This is Kathleen Gomez saying thank you for your vote for Michael D. Brown, your first choice for a better DC for all of us. This program was paid for by Michael D. Brown for Council 2014, Patricia E. Brown, Treasurer, 4501 Western Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20016. A copy of our report is on file with the Director of the Office of Campaign Finance for the District of Columbia. This program was produced by BBS Radio, all rights reserved. Again, thank you to the audience. Thank you to all those who Skyped in your questions this past five Sundays. It's been an interesting experience, and it's been a really great experience. I hope more people will do the same. Again, thank you, and we look forward to seeing you on November the 4th.